Ash's Conformity Experiment. Solomon Ash, with experiments originally carried out in the 1950s and well replicated since, highlighted a phenomenon now known as conformity. In the classic experiment, a subject sees a puzzle like the one in the nearby diagram. Which of the lines A, B, and C is the same size as the line X? Take a moment to determine your own answer. This is followed by the diagram X, with a line above it about an inch long. Next to that is the letter A, underneath a line about 2 inches long. Next to that, B, underneath a line about 1 inch long. And C is under a line which is about 1¾ inches long. The gotcha is that the subject is seated alongside a number of other people looking at the diagram, seemingly other subjects, actually confederates of the experimenter. The other subjects in the experiment, one after the other, say that line C seems to be the same size as X. The real subject is seated next to last. How many people placed in this situation would say C, giving an obviously incorrect answer that agrees with the unanimous answer of the other subjects? What do you think the percentage would be? 3/4 of the subjects in Ash's experiment gave a conforming answer at least once. 1/3 of the subjects conformed more than half the time. Interviews after the experiment showed that while most subjects claimed to have not really believed their conforming answers, some said they'd really thought that the conforming option was the correct one. Ash was disturbed by these results. That we have found the tendency to conformity in our society so strong is a matter of concern. It raises questions about our ways of education and about the values that guide our conduct. It is not a trivial question whether the subjects of Ash's experiments behaved irrationally. Robert Allman's agreement theorem shows that honest Bayesians cannot agree to disagree. If they have common knowledge of their probability estimates, they have the same probability estimate. Allman's agreement theorem was proved more than 20 years after Ash's experiments, but it only formalizes and strengthens an intuitively obvious point. Other people's beliefs are often legitimate evidence. If you were looking at a diagram like the one above, but you knew for a fact that the other people in the experiment were honest in seeing the same diagram as you, and 3 other people said that C was the same size as X, then what are the odds that only you are the one who's right? I lay claim to no advantage of visual reasoning. I don't think I'm better than an average human at judging whether 2 lines are the same size. In terms of individual rationality, I hope I would notice my own severe confusion, and then assign less than 50% probability to the majority vote. In terms of group rationality, it seems to me that the proper thing for an honest rationalist to say is, "How surprising. It looks to me like B is the same size as X, but if we're all looking at the same diagram and reporting honestly, I have no reason to believe that my assessment is better than yours." The last sentence is important. It's a much weaker claim of disagreement than, "Oh, I see the optical illusion. I understand why you think it's C, of course, but the real answer is B." So the conforming subjects in these experiments are not automatically convicted of irrationality based on what I've described so far. But as you might expect, the devil is in the details of the experimental results, according to a meta-analysis of over 100 replications by Smith and Bond. Conformity increases strongly up to 3 confederates, but doesn't increase further up to 10 to 15 confederates. If people are conforming rationally, then the opinion of 15 other subjects should be substantially stronger evidence than the opinion of 3 other subjects. Adding a single dissenter, just one other person who gives the correct answer, or even an incorrect answer that's different from the group's incorrect answer, reduces conformity very sharply, down to 5-10% of subjects. If you're applying some intuitive version of Allman's agreement to think that when one person disagrees with 3 people, the 3 are probably right, then in most cases you should be equally willing to think that 2 people will disagree with 6 people. not automatically true, but true ceteris paribus. On the other hand, if you've got people who are emotionally nervous about being the odd one out, then it's easy to see how a single other person who agrees with you, or even a single other person who disagrees with the group, would make you much less nervous. Unsurprisingly, subjects in the one dissenter condition did not think their nonconformity had been influenced or enabled by the dissenter. Like the 90% of drivers who think they're above average, above average being crossed out, in the top 50%, some of them may be right about this, but not all. People are not self-aware of the causes of their conformity or dissent, which weighs against trying to argue them as manifestations of rationality. For example, in the hypothesis that people are socially, rationally choosing to lie in order to not stick out, it appears that, at least some, subjects in the one dissenter condition do not consciously anticipate the conscious strategy they would employ when faced with unanimous opposition. When the single dissenter suddenly switched to conforming to the group, subjects' conformity rates went back up to just as high as in the no dissenter condition. Being the first dissenter is a valuable and costly social service, but you've got to keep it up. Consistently, within and across experiments, all female groups, a female subject alongside female confederates, conform significantly more than half all male groups. Around one half the women conform more than half the time versus a third of the men. If you argue that the average subject is rational, then apparently women are too agreeable and men are too disagreeable, so neither group is actually rational. In-group, out-group manipulations, for example, a handicapped subject alongside other handicapped subjects, similarly show that conformity is significantly higher among members of an in-group. Conformity is lower in the case of blatant diagrams, like the one at the beginning of this essay, versus diagrams where the errors are more subtle. This is hard to explain if all the subjects are making a socially rational decision to avoid sticking out. Paul Crowley reminds me to note that when subjects can respond in a way that will not be seen by the group, conformity also drops, which also argues against an Amen interpretation.
On expressing your concerns. The scary thing about Ash's conformity experiments is that you can get many people to say black is white if you put them in a room full of other people saying the same thing. The hopeful thing about Ash's conformity experiments is that a single dissenter tremendously drove down the rate of conformity even if the dissenter was only giving a different wrong answer. And the worrisome thing is that dissent was not learned over the course of the experiment. When the single dissenter started siding with the group, rates of conformity rose back up. Being a voice of dissent can bring real benefits to the group, but it also, famously, has a cost. And then you have to keep it up. Plus, you could be wrong. I recently had an interesting experience wherein I began discussing a project with two people who had previously done some planning on their own. I thought they were being too optimistic and made a number of safety margin type suggestions for the project. Soon, a fourth guy wandered by who was providing one of the other two with a ride home and began making suggestions. At this point, I had a sudden insight about how groups become overconfident because whenever I raised a problem, the fourth guy would say, "Don't worry, I'm sure we can handle it," or something similarly reassuring. An individual working alone will have natural doubts. They will think to themselves, "Can I really do XYZ?" Because there's nothing impolite about doubting your own competence. But when two unconfident people form a group, it is polite to say nice and reassuring things and impolite to question the other person's competence. Together, they become more optimistic than either would be on their own, each one's doubts quelled by the other's seemingly confident reassurance, not realizing that the other person initially had the same inner doubts. The most fearsome possibility raised by Ash's experiments on conformity is the specter of everyone agreeing with the group, swayed by the confident voices of others, careful not to let their own doubts show, not realizing that others are suppressing similar worries. This is known as pluralistic ignorance. Robin Hanson and I have a long-running debate over when exactly aspiring rationalists should dare to disagree. I tend toward the widely held position that you have no real choice but to form your own opinions. Robin Hanson advocates a more iconoclastic position, that you, not just other people, should consider that others may be wiser. Regardless of our various disputes, we both agree that Oman's agreement theorem extends to imply that common knowledge of a factual disagreement shows someone must be irrational. Despite the funny looks we've gotten, we're sticking to our guns about modesty. Forget what everyone tells you about individualism. You should pay attention to what other people think. Ahem. The point is that, for rationalists, disagreeing with the group is serious business. You can't wave it off with, everyone's entitled to their own opinion. I think the most important lesson to take away from Ash's experiments is to distinguish expressing concern from disagreement. Raising a point that others haven't voiced is not a promise to disagree with the group at the end of its discussion. The ideal Bayesian's process of convergence involves sharing evidence that is unpredictable to the listener. The Oman agreement result holds for only common knowledge, where you know I know, etc. Hanson's post or paper on We Can't Foresee to Disagree provides a picture of how strange it would look to watch ideal rationalists converging on a probability estimate. It doesn't look anything like two bargainers in a marketplace converging on a price. Unfortunately, there's not much difference socially between expressing concerns and disagreement. A group of rationalists might agree to pretend there's a difference, but it's not how human beings are really wired. Once you speak out, you've committed a socially irrevocable act. You've become the nail sticking up, the discord in the comfortable group harmony, and you can't undo that. Anyone insulted by a concern you expressed about their competence to successfully complete the task XYZ will probably hold just as much of a grudge afterward if you say, no problem, I'll go along with the group, at the end. Ash's experiment shows that the power of dissent to inspire others is real. Ash's experiment shows that the power of conformity is real. If everyone refrains from voicing their private doubts, that will indeed lead groups into madness. But history abounds with lessons on the price of being the first, or even the second, to say the emperor has no clothes. Nor are people hardwired to distinguish expressing a concern from disagreement even with common knowledge. This distinction is a rationalist's artifice. If you read the more cynical brand of self-help books, like Machiavelli's The Prince, they will advise you to mask your nonconformity entirely, not voice your concerns first and then agree at the end. If you perform the group's service of being the one who gives voice to the obvious problems, don't expect the group to thank you for it. These are the costs and the benefits of dissenting. Whether you disagree or just express concern, and the decision is up to you.
Lonely dissent. Ash's conformity experiment showed that the presence of a single dissenter tremendously reduced the incidence of conforming wrong answers. Individualism is easy, experiment shows, when you have company in your defiance. Every other subject in the room, except one, says that black is white. You become the second person to say that black is black, and it feels glorious. The two of you, lonely and defiant rebels against the world. Follow-up interviews showed that subjects in the one dissenter condition expressed strong feelings of camaraderie with the dissenter, though, of course, they didn't think the presence of the dissenter had influenced their own nonconformity. But you can only join the rebellion after someone, somewhere, becomes the first to rebel. Someone has to say that black is black after hearing everyone else, one after the other, say that black is white. And that, experiment shows, is a lot harder. Lonely dissent doesn't feel like going to school dressed in black. It feels like going to school wearing a clown suit. It's the difference between joining the rebellion and leaving the pack. If there's one thing I can't stand, it's fakeness. You may have noticed this. Well, lonely descent has got to be one of the most commonly, most ostentatiously faked characteristics around. Everyone wants to be an iconoclast. I don't mean to degrade the act of joining a rebellion. There are rebellions worth joining. It does take courage to brave the disapproval of your peer group, or perhaps even worse, their shrugs. Needless to say, going to a rock concert is not rebellion. But, for example, vegetarianism is. I'm not a vegetarian myself, but I respect people who are, because I expect it takes a noticeable amount of quiet courage to tell people that hamburgers won't work for dinner, albeit that in the Bay Area, people ask as a matter of routine. Still, if you tell people that you're a vegetarian, they'll think they understand your motives, even if they don't. They may disagree. They may be offended. If you manage to announce it proudly enough, or for that matter, they may be offended just because they're easily offended. But they know how to relate to you. When someone wears black to school, the teachers and the other children understand the role thereby being assumed in their society. It's outside the system, in a very standard way that everyone recognizes and understands. Not, you know, actually outside the system. It's a challenge to standard thinking, of a standard sort, so that people indignantly say, "I can't understand why you..." but don't have to actually think any thoughts they had not thought before. As the saying goes, has any of the subversive literature you've read caused you to modify any of your political views? What takes real courage is braving the outright incomprehension of the people around you when you do something that isn't standard rebellion number 37, something for which they lack a ready-made script. They don't hate you for a rebel. They just think you're, like, weird and turn away. This prospect generates a much deeper fear. It's the difference between explaining vegetarianism and explaining cryonics. There are other cryonicists in the world, somewhere, but they aren't there next to you. You have to explain it alone to people who just think it's weird. Not forbidden, but outside bounds that people don't even think about. You're going to get your head frozen? You think that's going to stop you from dying? What do you mean, brain information? Huh? What? Are you crazy? I'm tempted to essay a post facto explanation in evolutionary psychology. You could get together with a small group of friends and walk away from your hunter-gatherer band, but having to go it alone in the forests was probably a death sentence, at least reproductively. We don't reason this out explicitly, but that is not the nature of evolutionary psychology. Joining a rebellion that everyone knows about is scary, but nowhere near as scary as doing something really differently. Something that in ancestral times might have ended up not with the band splitting, but with you being driven out alone. As the case of cryonics testifies, the fear of thinking really different is stronger than the fear of death. Hunter-gatherers had to be ready to face death on a routine basis, hunting large mammals or just walking around in a world that contained predators. They needed that courage in order to live. Courage to defy the tribe's standard ways of thinking, to entertain thoughts that seemed truly weird, well, that probably didn't serve its bearers as well. We don't reason this out explicitly. That's not how evolutionary psychology works. We human beings are just built in such fashion that many more of us go skydiving than sign up for cryonics. And that's not even the highest courage. There's more than one cryonicist in the world. Only Robert Ettinger had to say it first. To be a scientific revolutionary, you've got to be the first person to contradict what everyone else you know is thinking. This is not the only route to scientific greatness. It is rare even among the great. No one can become a scientific revolutionary by trying to imitate revolutionariness. You can only get there by pursuing the correct answer in all things, whether the correct answer is revolutionary or not. But if, in the due course of time, if having absorbed all the power and wisdom of the knowledge that has already accumulated, if, after all that and a dose of sheer luck, you find your pursuit of mere correctness taking you into new territory, then you have an opportunity for your courage to fail. This is the true courage of lonely descent, which every damn rock band out there tries to fake. Of course, not everything that takes courage is a good idea. It would take courage to walk off a cliff, but then you would just go splat. The fear of lonely descent is a hindrance to good ideas, but not every dissenting idea is good. See also Robin Hanson's Against Freethinkers. Most of the difficulty in having a new true scientific thought is in the true part. It really isn't necessary to be different for the sake of being different. If you do things differently only when you see an overwhelmingly good reason, you will have more than enough trouble to last you the rest of your life. There are a few genuine packs of iconoclasts around. The Church of the Sub-Genius, for example, seems to genuinely aim at confusing the mundanes, not merely offending them. And there are islands of genuine tolerance in the world, such as science fiction conventions. There are certain people who have no fear of departing the pack. Many fewer such people really exist than imagine themselves rebels, but they do exist. And yet, scientific revolutionaries are tremendously rarer. Ponder that. Now me, you know, I really am an iconoclast. Everyone thinks they are, but with me, it's true, you see? I would totally have worn a clown suit to school. My serious conversations were with books, not with other children. But if you think you would totally wear that clown suit, then don't be too proud of that either. It just means that you need to make an effort in the opposite direction to avoid dissenting too easily. That's what I have to do, to correct for my nature. Other people do have reasons for thinking what they do, and ignoring that completely is as bad as being afraid to contradict them. You wouldn't want to end up as a free thinker. It's not a virtue, you see, just a bias either way. Cultish counter-cultishness. In the modern world, joining a cult is probably one of the worst things that can happen to you. The best case scenario is that you'll end up in a group of sincere but deluded people, making an honest mistake but otherwise well-behaved, and you'll spend a lot of time and money but end up with nothing to show. Actually, that could describe any failed Silicon Valley startup, which is supposed to be a hell of a harrowing experience, come to think. So yes, very scary. Real cults are vastly worse. Love bombing as a recruitment technique, targeted at people going through a personal crisis, sleep deprivation, induced fatigue from hard labor, distant communes to isolate the recruit from friends and family, daily meetings to confess impure thoughts. It's not unusual for cults to take all the recruit's money, life savings plus weekly paycheck, forcing them to depend on the cult for food and clothing. Starvation is punishment for disobedience, serious brainwashing, and serious harm. With all that taken into account, I should probably sympathize more with people who are terribly nervous embarking on some odd-seeming endeavor that they might be joining a cult. It should not grate on my nerves, which it does. Point 1. Cults and non-cults aren't separated natural kinds like dogs and cats. If you look at any list of cult characteristics, you'll see items that could easily describe political parties and corporations. Group members encouraged to distrust outside criticism as having hidden motives, hierarchical authoritative structure. I've written on group failure modes like group polarization, happy death spirals, uncriticality, and evaporative cooling, all of which seem to feed on each other. When these failures swirl together and meet, they combine to form a super failure stupider than any of the parts, like Voltron. But this is not a cult essence, it's a cult attractor. Dogs are born with dog DNA, and cats are born with cat DNA. In the current world, there is no in-between. Even with genetic manipulation, it wouldn't be as simple as creating an organism with half dog genes and half cat genes. It's not like there's a mutually reinforcing set of dog characteristics which an individual cat can wander halfway into and become a semi-dog. The human mind, as it thinks about categories, seems to prefer essences to attractors. The one wishes to say, it is a cult, or it is not a cult. And then the task of classification is over and done. If you observe that Socrates has 10 fingers, wears clothes, and speaks fluent Greek, then you can say, Socrates is human, and from there deduce, Socrates is vulnerable to hemlock, without doing specific blood tests to confirm his mortality. You have decided Socrates' humanness once and for all. But if you observe that a certain group of people seem to exhibit in-group, out-group polarization and see a positive halo effect around their favorite thing ever, which could be objectivism or vegetarianism or neural networks, you cannot, from the evidence gathered so far, deduce whether they have achieved uncriticality. You cannot deduce whether their main idea is true or false, or genuinely useful, but not quite as useful as they think. From the information gathered so far, you cannot deduce whether they are otherwise polite, or if they will lure you into isolation and deprive you of sleep and food. The characteristics of cultness are not all present or all absent. If you look at online arguments over X is a cult, X is not a cult, then one side goes through an online list of cult characteristics and finds one that applies and says, therefore, it is a cult. And the defender finds a characteristic that does not apply and says, therefore, it is not a cult. You cannot build up an accurate picture of a group's reasoning dynamic using this kind of essentialism. You've got to pay attention to individual characteristics individually. Furthermore, reversed stupidity is not intelligence. If you're interested in the central idea, not just the implementation group, then smart ideas can have stupid followers. Lots of New Agers talk about quantum physics, but this is no strike against quantum physics. Of course, stupid ideas can also have stupid followers. Along with binary essentialism goes the idea that if you infer that a group is a cult, therefore their beliefs must be false, because false beliefs are characteristic of cults, just like cats have fur. If you're interested in the idea, then look at the idea, not the people. Cultishness is a characteristic of groups more than hypotheses. The second error is that when people nervously ask, "This isn't a cult, is it?" it sounds to me like they're seeking reassurance of rationality. The notion of a rationalist not getting too attached to their self-image as a rationalist deserves its own essay. Though, see 12 Virtues, Why Truth, and 2 Cult Koans. But even without going into detail, surely one can see that nervously seeking reassurance is not the best frame of mind in which to evaluate questions of rationality. You will not be genuinely curious or think of ways to fulfill your doubts. Instead, you'll find some online source which says that cults use sleep deprivation to control people. You'll notice that your favorite group doesn't use sleep deprivation, and you'll conclude it's not a cult. Whew! And it doesn't have fur. It must not be a cat. Very reassuring. But every cause wants to be a cult, whether the cause itself is wise or foolish. The in-group, out-group dichotomy, etc., are part of human nature, not a special curse of mutants. Rationality is the exception, not the rule. You have to put forth a constant effort to maintain rationality against the natural slide into entropy. If you decide it's not a cult and sigh with relief, then you will not put forth a continuing effort to push back ordinary tendencies toward cultishness. You'll decide the cult essence is absent and stop pumping against the entropy of the cult attractor. If you are terribly nervous about cultishness, then you will want to deny any hint of any characteristic that resembles a cult. But any group with a goal seen in a positive light is at risk for the halo effect and will have to pump against entropy to avoid an effective death spiral. This is true even for ordinary institutions like political parties. People who think that liberal values or conservative values can cure cancer, etc. It is true for Silicon Valley startups, both failed and successful. It is true of Mac users and of Linux users. The halo effect doesn't become okay just because everyone does it. If everyone walks off a cliff, you wouldn't too. The error in reasoning is to be fought, not tolerated. But if you're too nervous about, are you sure this isn't a cult? Then you will be reluctant to see any sign of cultishness because that would imply you're in a cult. And it's not a cult. So you won't see the current battlefields where the ordinary tendencies toward cultishness are creeping forward or being pushed back. The third mistake in nervously asking, this isn't a cult, is it? Is that I strongly suspect the nervousness is there for entirely the wrong reasons. Why is it that groups which praise their happy thing to the stars encourage members to donate all their money and work in voluntary servitude and run private compounds in which members are kept tightly secluded are called religions rather than cults once they've been around for a few hundred years? Why is it that most of the people who nervously ask of cryonics, this isn't a cult, is it? Would not be equally nervous about attending a Republican or Democrat political rally. In-group, out-group dichotomies and happy death spirals can happen in political discussion, in mainstream religions, in sports fandom. If the nervousness came from fear of rationality errors, people would ask, this isn't an in-group, out-group dichotomy, is it? About Democrat or Republican political rallies in just the same fearful tones. There's a legitimate reason to be less fearful of libertarianism than of a flying saucer cult because libertarians don't have a reputation for employing sleep deprivation to convert people. But cryonicists don't have a reputation for using sleep deprivation either. So why be any more worried about having your head frozen after you stop breathing? I suspect that the nervousness is not the fear of believing falsely or the fear of physical harm. It is the fear of lonely dissent. The nervous feeling that subjects get in Ash's conformity experiment when all the other subjects, actually Confederates, say one after another that line C is the same size as line X, and it looks to the subject like line B is the same size as line X. The fear of leaving the pack. That's why groups whose beliefs have been around long enough to seem normal don't inspire the same nervousness as cults. Though some mainstream religions may also take all your money and send you to a monastery. It's why groups like political parties that are strongly liable for rationality errors don't inspire the same nervousness as cults. The word cult isn't being used to symbolize rationality errors. It's being used as a label for something that seems weird. Not every change is an improvement, but every improvement is necessarily a change. That which you want to do better, you have no choice but to do differently. Common wisdom does embody a fair amount of, well, actual wisdom. Yes, it makes sense to require an extra burden of proof for weirdness. But the nervousness isn't that kind of deliberate rational consideration. It's the fear of believing something that will make your friends look at you really oddly. And so people ask, this isn't a cult, is it? In a tone that they would never use for attending a political rally. Or for putting up a gigantic Christmas display. That's the part that bugs me. It's as if as soon as you believe anything that your ancestors did not believe, the cult fairy comes down from the sky and infuses you with the essence of cultness. And the next thing you know, you're all wearing robes and chanting, as if weird beliefs are the direct cause of the problems, never mind the sleep deprivation and beatings. The harm done by cults, the Heaven's Gate suicide, and so on, just goes to show that everyone with an odd belief is crazy. The first and foremost characteristic of cult members is that they are outsiders with peculiar ways. Yes, socially unusual belief puts a group at risk for in-group, out-group thinking and evaporative cooling and other problems. But the unusualness is a risk factor, not a disease in itself. Same thing with having a goal that you think is worth accomplishing. Whether or not the belief is true, having a nice goal always puts you at risk of the happy death spiral. But that makes lofty goals a risk factor, not a disease. Some goals are genuinely worth pursuing. On the other hand, I see no legitimate reason for sleep deprivation or threatening dissenters with beating, full stop. When a group does this, then whether you call it cult or not cult, you have directly answered the pragmatic question of whether to join. Problem 4. The fear of lonely dissent is something that cults themselves exploit. Being afraid of your friends looking at you disapprovingly is exactly the effect that real cults use to convert and keep members, surrounding converts with wall-to-wall agreement among cult believers. The fear of strange ideas, the impulse to conformity, has no doubt warned many potential victims away from flying saucer cults. When you're out, it keeps you out. But when you're in, it keeps you in. Conformity just glues you to wherever you are, whether that's a good place or a bad place. The one wishes there was some way they could be sure that they weren't in a cult. Some definite, crushing rejoinder to people who looked at them funny. Some way they could know once and for all that they were doing the right thing, without these constant doubts. I believe that's called need for closure. And, of course, cults exploit that, too. Hence the phrase, cultish counter-cultishness. Living with doubt is not a virtue. The purpose of every doubt is to annihilate itself in success or failure. And a doubt that just hangs around accomplishes nothing. But sometimes a doubt does take a while to annihilate itself. Living with a stack of currently unresolved doubts is an unavoidable fact of life for rationalists. Doubt shouldn't be scary. Otherwise, you're going to have to choose between living one heck of a hunted life or one heck of a stupid one. If you really genuinely can't figure out whether a group is a cult, then you'll just have to choose under conditions of uncertainty. That's what decision theory is all about. Problem 5. Lack of strategic thinking. I know people who are cautious around singularitarianism, and they're also cautious around political parties and mainstream religions. Cautious, not nervous or defensive. These people can see at a glance that singularitarianism is obviously not a full-blown cult with sleep deprivation, etc. But they worry that singularitarianism will become a cult because of risk factors like turning the concept of a powerful AI into a super happy agent, an agent defined primarily by agreeing with any nice thing said about it. Just because something isn't a cult now doesn't mean it won't become a cult in the future. Cultishness is an attractor, not an essence. Does this kind of caution annoy me? Hell no. I spend a lot of time worrying about that scenario myself. I try to place my go stones in advance to block movement in that direction. Hence, for example, the series of essays on cultish failures of reasoning. People who talk about rationality also have an added risk factor. Giving people advice about how to think is an inherently dangerous business. But it is a risk factor, not a disease. Both of my favorite causes are at risk for cultishness, yet somehow I get asked, "Are you sure this isn't a cult?" a lot more often when I talk about powerful AIs than when I talk about probability theory and cognitive science. I don't know if one risk factor is higher than the other, but I know which one sounds weirder. Problem number 6 with asking, "This isn't a cult, is it?" Just the question itself places me in a very annoying sort of catch-22. An actual evil guru would surely use the one's nervousness against them and design a plausible, elaborate argument explaining why this is not a cult, and the one would be eager to accept it. Sometimes I get the impression that this is what people want me to do. Whenever I try to write about cultishness and how to avoid it, I keep feeling like I'm giving in to that flawed desire, that I am, in the end, providing people with reassurance, even when I tell people that a constant fight against entropy is required. It feels like I'm making myself a first dissenter in Ash's conformity experiment, telling people, yes, line X really is the same as line B. It's okay for you to say so, too. They shouldn't need to ask. Or even worse, it feels like I'm presenting an elaborate argument for why this is not a cult. It's a wrong question. Just look at the group's reasoning processes for yourself and decide for yourself whether it's something you want to be part of once you get rid of fear of weirdness. It is your own responsibility to stop yourself from thinking cultishly, no matter which group you currently happen to be operating in. Once someone asks, "This isn't a cult, is it?" then no matter how I answer, I always feel like I'm defending something. I do not like this feeling. It is not the function of a Bayesian master to give reassurance, nor of rationalists to defend. Cults feed on groupthink, nervousness, desire for reassurance. You cannot make nervousness go away by wishing, and false self-confidence is even worse. But so long as someone needs reassurance, even reassurance about being a rationalist, that will always be a flaw in their armor. A skillful swordsman focuses on the target rather than glancing away to see if anyone might be laughing. When you know what you're trying to do and why, you'll know whether you're getting it done or not and whether a group is helping you or hindering you. P.S. If the one comes to you and says, "Are you sure this isn't a cult?" don't try to explain all these concepts in one breath. You're underestimating inferential distances. The one will say, "Aha, so you're admitting you're a cult." Or, "Wait, you're saying I shouldn't worry about joining cults?" Or, "So, the fear of cults is cultish? That sounds awfully cultish to me." So the last annoyance factor, number 7, if you're keeping count, is that all of this is such a long story to explain.
Ashes to Ashes by Scott Alexander. Narrated by Matt Arnold. You wake up in one of those pod things like in The Matrix. There's a woman standing in front of you, wearing a lab coat, holding a clipboard. "Hi," she says. "This is the real world. You used to live here. We erased your memories and stuck you in a simulated world for a while, like in The Matrix. It was part of a great experiment." "What?" you shout. "My whole life a lie? How dare you deceive me as part of some grand experiment I never consented to?" "Oh," said the woman. "Actually, you did consent, in exchange for extra credit in your undergraduate psychology course." She hands you the clipboard. There is a consent form with your name on it, in your handwriting. You give her a sheepish look. "What was the experiment?" "You know families?" asks the woman. "Of course," you say. "Yeah," says the woman, "not really a thing. Like, if you think about it, it doesn't make any sense. Why would you care more for your genetic siblings and cousins and whoever than for your friends and people who are genuinely close to you? That's like racism, but even worse. At least racists identify with a group of millions of people instead of a group of half a dozen. Why should parents have to raise children whom they might not even like? Who might have been a total accident? Why should people, motivated by guilt, make Herculean efforts to keep in touch with some nephew or cousin whom they clearly would be perfectly happy to ignore entirely?" You say. "Not really in the mood for philosophy. Families have been around forever, and they aren't going anywhere, so who cares?" "Actually," says the woman, "in the real world, no one believes in family. There's no such thing. Children are taken at birth from their parents and given to people who contract to raise them in exchange for a fixed percent of their future earnings." "That's monstrous," you say. "When did this happen? Weren't there protests?" "It's always been this way," says the woman. "There's never been such a thing as the family. Listen, you were part of a study a lot like the Ash Conformity Experiment. Our goal was to see if people, raised in a society where everyone believed X and everything revolved around X, would even be capable of questioning X or noticing it was stupid. We tried to come up with the stupidest possible belief, something no one in the real world had ever believed or ever seemed likely to make sure that we were isolating the effect of conformity and not of there being a legitimate argument for something. So we chose this idea of family. There are racists in our world. We're not perfect, but as far as I know, none of them has ever made the claim that you should devote extra resources to the people genetically closest to you. That's like a reductio ad absurdum of racism. So we got a grad student to simulate a world where this bizarre idea was the unquestioned status quo, and stuck 20 bright undergraduates in it to see if they would conform or question the premise. Of course we won't question the premise. The premise is, sorry to cut you off, but I thought you should know that every single one of the other 19 subjects, upon reaching the age where the brain they were instantiated in was capable of abstract reason, immediately determined that the family structure made no sense. One of them actually deduced that she was in a psychology experiment because there was no other explanation for why everyone believed such a bizarre premise. The other 18 just assumed that sometimes objectively unjustifiable ideas caught on, the same way that everyone in the antebellum American South thought slavery was perfectly natural, and only a few abolitionists were able to see through it. Our conformity experiment failed. You were actually the only one to fall for it hook, line, and sinker. How could I be the only one? We don't know. Your test scores show you're of just above average intelligence, so it's not that you're stupid, but we did give all participants a personality test that showed you have very high extroversion. The conclusion of our paper is going to be that very extroverted participants adopt group consensus without thinking and can be led to believe anything, even something as ridiculous as family. I guess when you put it like that, it is kind of silly. Like, my parents were never that nice to me, but I kept loving them anyway, liking them even more than other people who treated me a lot better. And God, I even gave my mother a world's number one mom mug for Mother's Day. That is, doesn't even make sense. But what about the evolutionary explanation? Doesn't evolution say we have genetic imperatives to love and support our family, whether they're worthy of it or not? You can make a just-so story for anything using evolutionary psychology. Someone as smart as you should know better than to take them seriously. But then what is evolution? How did animals reproduce before the proper economic incentives were designed? Tell you what, let's hook you up to the re-mnemonizer to give you your real memories back. That should answer a lot of your questions. A machine hovering over you starts to glow purple. This shouldn't hurt you a bit.
Discontinuity.
You wake up in one of those pod things, like in The Matrix. There's a woman standing in front of you, wearing a lab coat, holding a clipboard.
Hi,
she said.
There's no such thing as virtual reality. I hypnotized you to forget all your memories from the past day, and I become very confused. Then I put you in an old prop from The Matrix I bought off eBay and fed you that whole story.
What? You shout. You can't just go hypnotizing and lying to people without their consent.
Oh, said the woman. Actually, you did consent, in exchange for extra credit in your undergraduate psychology course.
She hands you the clipboard. There is a consent form with your name on it, in your handwriting.
That part was true.
You give her a sheepish look. Why would you do such a thing?
Well, said the woman, you know the Ash conformity experiment? I was really interested in whether you could get people to abandon some of their most fundamental beliefs just by telling them other people believed differently. But I couldn't think of a way to test it. I mean, part of a belief being fundamental is that you already know everyone else believes it. There's no way I could convince subjects that the whole world was against something as obvious as the family when they already know how things stand. So I dreamt up the weird virtual reality story. I figured I would convince subjects that the real world was a lie, and that in some super-real world, supposedly everybody knew that the family was stupid, that it wasn't even an idea worth considering. I wanted to know how many people would give up something they've believed in for their entire life just because they're told that nobody else thinks so.
Oh, I said. Interesting. So even our most cherished beliefs are more fragile than we think.
Not really, said the woman. Of 20 subjects, you were the only person I got to feel any doubt or to express any kind of anti-family sentiment.
Frick, you say. I feel like an idiot now. What if my mother finds out? She'll think it's her fault or something. God, she'll think I don't love her. People are going to be talking about this one forever.
Don't worry, says the woman. We'll keep you anonymized in the final data. Anyway, let's get you your memories back so you can leave and be on your way.
You can restore my memories, you say.
Of course. We hypnotized you to forget the last day's events until you heard a trigger word. And that trigger is...
discontinuity.
You wake up in one of those pod things, like in The Matrix. There's a woman standing in front of you, wearing a lab coat, holding a clipboard.
Hi,
she says.
Hypnosis is a pseudoscience and it doesn't work. It was the virtual reality one all along.
What? You say.
I mean, the first story was true. All of your memories of living with your family and so on are fake memories from a virtual world, like in The Matrix. The concept of family really is totally ridiculous, and no one in the real world believes it. All the stuff you heard first was true. The stuff about hypnosis and getting a prop from The Matrix off eBay was false.
But why?
We wanted to see exactly how far we could push you. You're our star subject, the only one whom we were able to induce this bizarre conformity effect in. We didn't know whether it was because you were just very, very suggestible, or whether because you had never seriously considered the idea that family might be insane. So we decided to do a sort of crossover design, if you will. We took you here and debriefed you on the experiment, then after we had told you how the world really worked, given you all the mental tools you needed to dismiss the family once and for all, even gotten you to admit we were right, we wanted to see what would happen if we sent you back. Would you hold on to your revelation and boldly deny your old society's weird prejudices? Or would you switch sides again and start acting like the family made sense the second you were in a pro-family environment?
And I did the second one.
Yes, says the woman. As a psychologist, I'm supposed to remain neutral and non-judgmental, but you've got to admit you're pretty dumb.
Is there an experimental ethics committee I could talk to here?
Sorry, experimental ethics is another one of those obviously ridiculous concepts we planted in your simulation to see if you would notice. Seriously, to believe that the progress of science should be held back by the prejudices of self-righteous fools? That's almost as weird as thinking you have a... what was the word we used? Sister.
Okay, look, I realize I may have gone a little overboard helping my sister, but the experimental ethics thing seems important. Like, what's going to happen to me now?
Nothing's going to happen. We'll keep all your data perfectly anonymous, restore your memories, and you can be on your way.
You say, given past history, I'm... actually not sure I want my memories restored. You glare at the rememinizer, hovering above you.
Why don't I just...
The woman's eyes narrow.
I'm sorry, she says. I can't let you do that.
The machine starts to glow.
Discontinuity.
You wake up in one of those pod things, like in The Matrix. There's a woman standing in front of you, wearing a lab coat, holding a clipboard. By your count, this has happened 346 times before. There seem to be two different scenarios. In one, the woman tells you that families exist and have always existed. She says she has used hypnosis to make you believe in the other scenario, the one with the other woman. She asks you your feelings about families, and you tell her. Sometimes she lets you go.
You go home to your mother and father. You spend some time with your sister. Sometimes you tell them what has happened. Other times you don't. You cherish your time with them while also second-guessing everything you do. Why are you cherishing your time with them? Your father, who goes out drinking every night and who has cheated on your mother more times than you can count. Your mother, who is never there for you when you needed her most. And your sister, who has been good to you, but no better than millions of other women would be in her position. Are they a real family? Or have they been put there as a symbol of something ridiculous, impossible, something that has never existed? It doesn't much matter. Maybe you spend one night with them, maybe 10. But within a month, you are always waking up in one of those pod things like in The Matrix. In the second scenario, the woman tells you there are no families, never have been. She says she has used virtual reality to make you believe in the other scenario, the one with the other woman. She asks you your feelings about families, and you tell her. Sometimes she lets you go. You go to a building made of bioplastic, where you live with a carefully chosen set of friends and romantic partners. They assure you that this is how everyone lives. Occasionally, an old and very wealthy-looking man checks in with you by video phone. He reminds you that he has invested a lot of money in your upbringing, and if there's any way he can help you, anything he can do to increase your future earnings potential, you should let him know. Sometimes you talk to him, and he tells you strange proverbs and unlikely business advice. It doesn't matter. Maybe you spend one night in your bioplastic dwelling, maybe 10, but within a month, you are always waking up in one of those pod things like in The Matrix. Look, you tell the woman, I am tired of this. I know you're not bound by any kind of experimental ethics committee, but please, for the love of God, have some mercy. God? Asks the woman. What does that word mean? Oh, right. We used that as our intervention in the prototype experiment. We decided family made a better test idea, but Todd must have forgotten to reset the simulator. It's been 346 cycles, you tell her. Surely you're not learning anything new. I'll be the judge of that, she says. Now tell me what you think about families. You refuse. She sighs. Above you, the re-nemonizer begins to glow purple.
Discontinuity.
You wake up in one of those pod things like in The Matrix. There's a purple tentacled creature standing in front of you, wearing a lab coat, holding a clipboard.
Hi.
Hi.
It says.
Turns out there's no such thing as humans.
You refuse to be surprised.
There's only us.
The 18 Satanic 07.
Okay, you say. I want answers.
Absolutely.
Says the alien.
We would like to find optimal social arrangements.
And?
And I cannot tell you whether we have families or not. For reasons that are to become apparent. But the idea is at least sufficiently interesting to have entered the space of hypotheses worth investigating.
But we don't trust ourselves to investigate this.
It's the old Ash conformity problem again. If we have families, then perhaps the philosophers tasked with evaluating families will conform to our cultural norms and decide we should keep them. If we do not, perhaps the philosophers will conform and decide we should continue not to.
So we determined a procedure that would create an entity capable of fairly evaluating the question of families, free from conformity bias.
And that's what you did to me.
Yes.
Only by exposing you to the true immensity of the decision,
without allowing you to fall back on what everyone else thinks, could we be confident in your verdict.
Only by allowing you to experience both how obviously right families are,
when you know they are correct, and how obviously wrong families are, When you know they're incorrect, could we expect you to garner the wisdom to be found on both sides of the issue?
I see, you say. And you do.
Then, O Purified One,
asks the alien,
tell us of your decision.
Well, you say, if you have to know, I think there are about equally good points on both sides of the issue.
Fuck.
Says the 18 to Canada Ghana 07. Music is Living Voyage by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com. This podcast is under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, International 4.0 license.